support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge. Glad you could listen. During this hour of the show, we will talk about Happily Married with Kids. That's the title of the book written by our guest, Carol Ummel Lindquist. She is a family therapist with 25 years' experience, and the book draws on that experience as a family therapist, also conducting a bunch of workshops for parents, and also her own experience as someone who is happily married with kids. And we'll talk about the common experiences that people have when they become parents. Obviously, kids change everything, and often relationships change dramatically and sometimes do not survive the transition. We'll talk about the ingredients that go into succeeding with parenting, and as we do so, we invite you into the conversation. That's what this show is all about. If you would like to join us, all you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you match the letters with the numbers, that's what you get. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here or via the internet anywhere in the continental U.S., 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. And Dr. Lindquist, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
We should also mention at the outset that you are here in town, actually, and you'll be doing a book signing tomorrow at Pages for All Ages?
That's correct, yeah.
At 2 p.m.?
At 2 p.m. I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. That's Pages for All Ages in Savoy, Illinois. For people around Champaign-Urbana, certainly people know where that is, but again, 2 p.m. Just let's start talking about some of the, one of the basic questions that I always hate when talk show hosts ask this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it seems appropriate. Why did you write this book?
Well, I noticed that, I began to notice when my kids were about four that the fights that my husband and I had, or the disagreements or the arguments that when our kids were two, three, and four, were the same fights that my friends were having. And I thought, you know, maybe there's something going on that's common to everybody here, and we're not just off in our own isolated corner of the world. Mm-hmm. And then I started reading about it in depth as a psychologist. I was curious about what the research was, and I found out that indeed the most difficult time in your married life is when your kids are between the ages of two and five. I thought, oh, that's why we're having such a hard time. And it was very comforting to me to know that I wasn't alone. And I thought it would be fun to write a book to really spell out all the things that happened to your marriage in that brief period of time that's so intense.
Mm-hmm. It seems that all new parents go through this feeling of, you know, sort of being besieged, I guess, and oftentimes feeling like, you know, they're alone in this. Uh-huh. But it really is reassuring to read about sort of the similar kinds of transitions that other parents go through, and in many ways the same stages, the same periods of time. It's almost predictable. Uh-huh. what you know, in reading your book and also reflecting on my own experience. Uh-huh. The experiences are repeated by parents everywhere.
Yes, and yet they're so busy with their kids, they're not necessarily, the moms may be sharing a little bit, mm-hmm. but they're not necessarily sharing, and they don't have that long-term view that your marriage is going to start out close together and you're going to move farther apart in the division of labor of trying to get everything done and then probably come back and be closer than you ever were. I think people don't see that come back and be closer than you ever were. They see the, oh, God, this is not what I signed up for.
It's awfully hard to see the long-term in the middle, yes, of the crisis.
Especially since we don't often live with extended families around us in our community anymore, so that it's harder to talk with people that have that longer-term perspective because they've lived through a happy marriage.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you start out with in the book, and I think explore in depth in as the chapters proceed, are the expectations that we have about what our life is going to be like, mm-hmm, pre and post children. And that maybe that's one of the big problems, is that we have these expectations or fantasies about the children are going to come along and our lives are going to change in these particular ways. And they change in maybe very different ways than we expected.
Yeah, I think we expect that we'll be sitting at home, cozy, you know, doing things, and it's chaotic, and there's, you know, miles of toys on the floor that you're trying to pick up, and you're trying to, you no longer can say, let's go to the movies and get up and go to the movies. It's an event to plan how to, who's going to watch the child and how to get out of the house, and sometimes it seems overwhelming, and, intimate life is gone in some ways just because of all the disruption, and you have to plan that too, which you didn't have to plan when you were without kids. And so there are a lot of things that change. You know, you think you're going to get closer, but emotionally you begin to deal with very different issues. Women start to deal with who am I going to be? I was a career person, now I'm a mom. How do I combine those two things? Men start to say, well, what's my legacy? What am I leaving behind? I have to make more money now. They feel a lot more pressure. So instead of feeling closer as parents, which they do initially in that first bliss, they also start to develop very different lives sometimes and don't feel closer, even though they thought they would as a result of having children.
Well, I want to talk more about that. We do have a caller waiting, and instead of making them wait, let's include them in our conversation.
Sure.
This is a listener in Aurora on line number 4. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
How nice that you are giving information for those that need it. I have a friend that had her daughter from an abused marriage come in to live with her with two teenagers, 17 and 22. I thought it was a horrendous thing for my friend to do, put three generations together. The 17-year-old is told that her boyfriend has to leave at 10:30. Well, of course, she would not meet the rules. So her mother and her grandmother took the door off the room.
Wow.
Which I thought was a wonderful thing. I would have never thought of it.
It's clear action. I think it's a pretty good thing, yeah.
Okay, but what do you do? And she called me up to ask me. I had no answer to the rest other question. What do you do when the granddaughter now puts sheets up?
Well, I think you can put the sheets up, but you can also tell her that you may be knocking on the door, or you may be walking in. So she's going to take her own risks on that one.
What? Should she take the sheets down? I don't understand.
I think I would let the daughter have the sheets, but I would tell her that I'm going to knock on the door, or I would come in and ask him to leave if I were uncomfortable with it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, so she still should go through the other behavior of asking the girl, the boyfriend, to leave.
Yes. Yeah, you knock on the door and say, it's 10:30, we're closing down here tonight. See you later. Thanks for coming over.
I heard this on Dr. Phil, and in all my years of bringing up children, I never thought of this, and I'm glad I didn't at the time. But he said to avoid confrontation with your child. But if you do, don't lose.
Yeah, which part bothers you about that?
What?
What part bothers you about that?
Well, I'm glad I didn't have to have that problem.
I think it's better to avoid the confrontation. I think the first part of the message is the most important.
Yeah, to avoid it. Yeah, yeah. Thank you much.
All right, thanks so much.
Thanks for calling.
You. Thanks for the call. I have a 9-year-old daughter, and she's already almost a teenager. And this idea of avoiding confrontation, while sounding very appealing, you know, I wonder how practical it's always going to be.
Well, the thing that helped me the most with that is I would try to frame everything as a choice.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can leave the sheet up, but I'm probably going to be knocking on the door and walking in. So which one do you want? You know, you can leave the sheet down and I probably won't be knocking on the door. So take your choice. So I tried to, as often as possible with my kids, say, well, you could do that, but these are some of the things that may happen. And you could also try this and this. Trying to make the choices that I didn't like the least attractive.
You know, since we're talking about this, I have another area I want to get back to. But it seems that often there is an issue of control that, you know, and I think parents, you know, we often feel like we have to control our children, or that there's that then becomes the issue instead of why are we trying to control them? You know, what is it, the behavior that we're most interested in as opposed to, you know, just simply being in control?
Well, I think it what helps me to remember, since I like to be in control, I think a lot of parents do,
yeah,
is that what I'm really doing is preparing my children to go out on their own, and I don't want them to be the kinds of kids that go to college and collapse because it's the first time they've ever made a choice in their life. So I try to, whenever I get in my control place, I try to come back to, okay, what are the choices here? What is it I'm actually trying to have them think about? Because the more choices I give them now, of course, limiting the choices, I don't want to give them endless choices and have them collapse. But if I can limit the choices so that they can think it through and make a good choice, I'm really preparing them for the day that I'm going to have to let them go. And, of course, that's in gradation over time. But still, if you look at it that way, I used to look at it like, well, what kind of parent am I if my kids won't behave? But then I realized I'm the kind of parent that raises kids that think. That's a good thing.
We're talking this morning with Carol Ummel Lindquist, last name Lindquist. She's a family therapist, and we're discussing her book, Happily Married with Kids, and welcoming your questions if you'd like to join us, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. It's really a wonderfully written book, I have
to say.
And there was so much in it that rings familiar as someone with two kids. How did you had obviously some people helping you with the stories and a lot of the resources and so forth. Do you want to talk about how the book kind of came together?
Well, actually, what brings me to Champaign-Urbana is that I had a friend from graduate school, because I went to graduate school here at University of Illinois, who had married a wonderful woman who wrote brilliant Christmas letters and was a therapist. And so I sent her a copy of the book. It's Deborah Allen, and she works as a therapist here in Champaign. And she turned out to be better than some of my paid editors in terms of understanding what the point of the book was and giving me just beautiful words to help and some good stories. So that's one of the things that I did, is I gave it both to I gave it to Debbie. I also gave it to a couple of men that I thought were wonderful fathers and good husbands, to see their feedback about how they felt about what I was writing. And it was very helpful. It's surprising, you know, as a woman, the things that are familiar to you may not be familiar to a male. So it was good to have men read it and have therapists read it and have clients read it to give me feedback, to see that it reached people, that they understood what I was saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, very good. One of the issues that you just mentioned and is raised in the book as well is, you know, the sort of differences in gender roles that occur with parenting. And this is also going back to the discussion of what people's expectations are. And I do think that we have been, as a culture, adjusting to the idea of you know, that we really are equal partners in society and culture and politics and our family life and so forth. And, you know, we're still adjusting because we haven't quite gotten there in many ways. But it's interesting to see the transition between, you know, pre-parenting marriages where there is this attitude that, you know, we're equal partners, and then all of a sudden the children come along and maybe some of those expectations kind of change without our necessarily thinking in advance that they will.
Yeah, it sort of starts to happen. And what we try to hold in our marriage, and what I try to hold, is that we're equal in terms of the respect that we give each other as human beings, but we may not have exactly parallel lives as we did before the kids came along because we're doing different things. The other thing that was interesting for me, as we began to have so much division and labor of, you know, who's going to cover what time and all that, that I became aware of when I was writing the book, is the difference between men and women's approach to negotiation and cooperation. Mm-hmm. Men tend to be negotiators. They don't think in terms of history. They're right in the moment, and they sort of respect each other in terms of, think about two guys that are going on a trip. You know, you get the beer, I'll do this. You know, it's a very in-the-moment plan it out, where women tend to operate from a, I'll be nice to you, you know, I'll do these nice things and you'll pay me back. And women tend to expect, if they're nice, that the other person will volunteer in return. And when you put those two negotiating styles together, men tend to feel very frustrated. They'll say their women have their wives have this incredible memory, and their history goes back forever and ever to, you know, should be on microfilm, back in the stacks. And women remember things because they think that they're banking for the future. And until you get that out in the open and start to work together in a way that either one of you, you know, you get some appreciation for the woman's giving to get approach and you get some appreciation for the man's, let's just make it straightforward. Mm-hmm. Spell it out to me. What do you want help with here? That they often miss each other, and women feel, you know, men feel unfairly attacked, and women feel like, well, you don't really love me if you're not going to pay back, you know, if you're not going to be as kind to me as I am to you. So
this, our rules are kind of different.
The basic rule of engagement is different.
It's very interesting. Yeah. And that really comes into play at, you know, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
When when the baby's crying and somebody's got to feed it. And, you know, this is also, and this plays into the biological differences between men and women as well, because most men can't breastfeed. Let's put it like that. So, you know, then, how do you go about being fair?
Yes, yes. I actually was very interested, and I interviewed a lot of couples about how they do it. They did it. Some couples, the husband always gets up, goes and gets the baby, and brings it to the wife so that he's the one standing up so she doesn't get so wide awake. With some couples, she does all the getting up, the breastfeeding, but then she has chunks of time that they set aside for her to sleep in. So it's interesting how couples that are interested in some, not equality, but basic fairness, come up with different kinds of solutions to solve that problem and a lot of different problems.
Yeah. One of the things that gets in the way of that, of course, is just the sheer exhaustion, which, you know, you don't really anticipate when you have people tell you, oh, yeah, just you wait. But you don't know until you get there. And then that certainly does something to your brain and your ability to treat each other in a, you know,
respectful
sort of
way.
Thank you. That's the word. Exactly.
Yes. People can have fabulous communication skills at work. Mm-hmm. And then when you bring them home and they're together, they have wonderful communication skills. But you put them under stress and they will regress to the worst communication skills that they saw their parents do. And most of us swore we wouldn't do what our parents did unless we had wonderful parents. And so they start doing things that they can't believe what comes out of their mouth. And they do put downs and argue in ways that are very destructive to the marriage. And as couples, it's important to watch your communication skills under stress and try to use the same ones that you would use out in public with your spouse, because this is the most important person who's going to be with you the longest amount of time unless you end up getting divorced.
We're talking this morning with Carol Ummel Lindquist. She is a family therapist, and we're discussing her book, Happily Married with Kids. This is published by Berkeley Press. And also want to mention again that she will be doing a book signing tomorrow at 2 p.m. at Pages for All Ages bookstore in Savoy in the Champaign-Urbana area. And certainly feel free to attend that if you'd like to meet her and pick up a copy of the book. And also feel free to join us if you have questions. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. The issue of changing identity when, sort of becoming something bigger or different when you become a parent seems very intriguing to me, because I noticed a lot of changes in myself, and also my wife felt the same way. It's also complicated because without even knowing it, I sort of expected her to change in ways that I didn't think in advance. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't, you know, sit down and go, oh, I expect my wife is going to change in these particular ways. But I think that I found that I did have those assumptions, that she was going to become, you know, more maternal and maybe, you know,
cook more, maybe.
Yeah, cook more. Maybe the house would be cleaner. Ha.
Yeah.
Good luck.
And in fact, that a lot of men think the house will be cleaner because she's home. And actually, some women think that. But with the child tottering around the house, and you're exhausted with the infant, and then they're on the go, and you have the toddler decorating with everything up, you know, on the fireplace mantle. And it's very hard. And it was interesting to me when I interviewed, because I worked part time to interview nanny agencies, the first thing they'd say is, now you don't expect this person to do any house cleaning because you can't take care of a child and clean house. And I thought, ah, well, gee, a lot of people think that you can do that. And a lot of fights that you know people come in initially about are things about household tasks. The other thing I talk about in the book is what we call around our office housekeeper therapy, where people have this expectation of a perfect house and a perfect child when they come home, and it's just nearly impossible to do. And they'll come in complaining that, you know, we don't have any sexual relationship anymore, which is a normal thing that happens in this 2-5 thing. And I'll say, well, do you have any household help? No. And I say, well, why don't you try that for a few weeks before we start therapy? And they won't need therapy. Their marital relations will resume. Things will be good because they've taken the pressure off, the expectations that they both put on the wife off, and then she has energy to do that. And then they'll come to therapy and we'll solve whatever other problems that they have about money or whatever, and they'll go away for a while, and then I'll get a phone call and they'll say, we need to come back. And I'll say, do you still have your housekeeper? And they will have decided they could get along without it.
That's really interesting. Well, that raises the issue of expectation, not only the individual's and the couple's expectation, but maybe societal expectations. We're still kind of grappling with, gender roles, obviously, in the workplace. And whose job is it to raise the children? And, is the father, what is the difference between a father and a mother and so forth? And it just seems that we're still very confused about those things.
Well, and I think what happens is most men are doing so much more around the house mm-hmm. than their fathers did that they think they're just, slaves practically. Mm-hmm. And yet if you look at the time studies, when they actually do time studies, on the average, once you have a child, a woman is doing 275% more of the joint work around the house than the husband is doing. So she's really working hard. And we don't, as a society, really have a way of thinking about that or doing it so that women do get stressed out and you do need housekeeper therapy. I think in cultures that were earlier, help in the terms of the village helping was very common. But we live more isolated lives now, and people try to do it all. And you can't do. I mean, you can do it all if you don't care that you have a messy house. Sometimes you can do it all if you're, willing to let some things go. But you can't do it all if you want your house to look like a magazine and you magazine layout, I guess I should say. And you expect your child to be perfectly attended and cared for. Won't happen.
Do you think people commonly fail to recognize the contribution of the other person?
Yeah, I think when you're tired, you're far less appreciative. I think that gratitude is the glue of marriage, and I think when you look at happily married couples, they'll spontaneously say, oh, my spouse is so fabulous. They do this, this, and this. Most people under stress forget to do compliments. It's just like they put their head down and let's see if we can get the work done. And the relationship falls apart if that's the choice that you make.
How do you work on that?
Well, I do this thing I talk about in the book called the positive game, which I actually started with my kids because I found myself as they got older being more critical as I got more controlling and demanding. And the positive game was trying to always put any request in the positive instead of saying, why didn't you take the trash out? Mm-hmm. And say, honey, will you take the trash out? Or instead of – so we would – I could give you a million examples of that. I won't go down that road. But the idea is putting everything that you talk about in the positive. And then there's also the 5-to-1 rule about in happily married couples, there are different styles of happily married couples. But the one thing they all have in common is in a conflict, they give 5 more pieces of positive feedback than negative feedback. So they either give compliments or they'll touch each other or they'll remind each other of shared values that they have in the process of arguing. And I thought, I'm not making 5-1.
I thought it was 3-1, but now it's 5. Okay.
Well, for married couples, it's 5. Okay. In conflict. It's not like every minute of the day. It's in conflict. And it. So what I did for myself is I said, I'm going to try to make 5 compliments. Well, if you have to think of 5 compliments before you give a criticism, your criticisms get a lot more expensive. You don't just sort of randomly, as you come through, say, why didn't you pick up this? Why didn't you do that? Da-da-da-da-da. And so I try to get couples to work with that. You know, is this criticism so important that you're willing to come up with 5 compliments? Or is it so important that you're willing to schedule it once a week to talk about it? And it's amazing how many criticisms aren't that important. So
we're talking this morning with Carol Emma Lindquist. She's a family therapist and author of the book we're discussing, Happily Married with Kids. She's also a board-certified clinical psychologist and professor emerita of psychology at California State Fullerton, and she's been involved in training other marital therapists for a long time. And we're welcoming your questions as well if you'd like to join us. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You just mentioned something that I wanted to ask you about, and that's, you know, sort of the scheduling of conversations. And a lot of times when you get so incredibly busy and stressed out and so many of your best laid plans go out the window because, you know, you've got the kids and work and the house and everything else, it initially seems very artificial to schedule conversations with your spouse or to schedule sex, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Is it the way to go, basically, in a lot of cases.
I think it's the way to go. I think your life has changed so much. And what I try to do is have couples look back to when you were dating and, you know, you spent the day figuring out what you were going to wear and where you were going to go and what you were going to do and maybe some topics of conversation. And really, I think, scheduled a lot, even though you saw that as, quote, spontaneous. And I think the period when, if you have a good honeymoon period after the wedding, you get a lot of more spontaneity. You really can operate in a more spontaneous thing. But once the children come, I try to encourage people to have 2 kinds of dates, work dates and play dates. And I try to encourage them to have, you know, once a week, even once a month. I know couples that do it once a quarter where they go away for a weekend, if that's something you can tolerate, being away from your kids that long. But the idea is that in that time, you won't discuss how you're going to divide the labor and who's going to do what. And I then look for a time of day when you can do this sort of, or a time, some people do it once a week on Sunday where they schedule what's going to happen for the week. And some people do it tea after dinner. Some people do it first thing in the morning. Some people do it by email, that work thing, because that doesn't have to be so much a cuddle time where you want your fun date. Not so much to plan having sex, but to plan that you could have sex if you're rested up enough to do it. And it's funny to think about sex being that hard. But when you're tired, it seems different. And then to have another time that's more like a meeting where you really make your life function and plan some fun things and plan vacations and stuff like that. So
we have a caller to talk with. Let's include them.
Okay.
We'll go to line number 4, someone on a cell phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi.
Quick question. I realize this is a big question, but any advice or counsel or resource you might suggest? Someone who has had a daughter move back with a brand new baby, no husband in the picture, obviously a kind of a stressful situation. Any advice and counsel or resources you might suggest for a kind of a family situation like that? I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you very much.
Okay. Actually, the scheduling thing that we were just talking about, if you could schedule time for the daughter to get away once a week, and you could schedule some, like a caretaking time for where you as whoever it is, grandparents or whatever your role is, can know that you're going to spend time alone with the child. It's you want her to have time to recharge her batteries and to become independent and reconnect with the social world and stuff like that. So it's a good idea, even though you're not planning couple time, what you're planning is the possibility that couple time will reoccur, if that's at all possible. Also, the situation you're talking about where kids move back in with their parents and is very, very common today. And I don't off the top of my head have the references for that, but there are groups available where you can chat online or get their resources, because it's a very, very common situation these days. Hope that helps.
Hope that does help indeed. Well, we were talking, you know, you mentioned that it takes a village idea. And changes in society, there are fewer extended families, there are fewer community and neighborhood kinds of relationships. On the other hand, you suggest some ways that maybe you can build some of those relationships.
Yeah, I really go through and think about which are the valuable relationships. I lived a long way from, I have a wonderful large extended family, and I live a long way from my family. And so it got me to thinking about what I used and needed as my village here, because I had grown up in a small town and I wanted to recreate some of that feeling. So I talked about some ways that you can pick your babysitters carefully, that sort of so that they can have sort of a grandmotherly role in the family, or they can be kids that would be good models for your kids, and how to get into groups that are child centered, and talked about babysitting co-ops as a way to meet people that are interested in providing quality childcare and not, you know, sort of help you when your budget's tight. The village is an interesting concept, because you not only have to, it's not only very helpful to develop a supportive village, it's helpful for teaching your kids values to give back to the village, and it's also a time when you need to draw lines with your village, because in this day and age, there's so many people that get, particularly in California where I live, that you're drawn into all kinds of athletics and competitions and dance things and so forth, so that family time is completely eroded. And so as a family, you not only have to invite the village in, you have to structure it so that you keep the village out sometimes and you leave room for just our family time.
One of the suggestions that I read in your book I thought was really interesting is parents of young children should make friends with parents that have children, you know, maybe 2-3 years older than their own children, so they can kind of see what's coming and get some real good guidance.
I think it's wonderfully reassuring, because when it happens to your kids, then you're ready. And also, it had wonderful benefits for my kids as teenagers, because when the kids across the street, who were wonderful kids, you know, had the wild party when their parents were out of town, they came home and said, "Oh, Mom, I'm never doing that. That's way out of control." I thought, gee, that was a free lesson, you know.
Wow, that's interesting.
So there were things like that where these friends give them a sense of safety when they move to high school, these kids that are a little bit older, because they feel like they're being welcomed by friends. So it's had a lot of good benefits for both my kids. And for us as parents.
I can imagine. Well, we just have about 20 minutes left with our guest, Carol Ummel Lindquist, author of the book Happily Married with Kids. It's not just a fairy tale. It's a great book. It resonates with everything I've learned the hard way. And we have time to take calls if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Getting back to the evolution of the relationship after having kids, there was I was just looking for it and failed to find it. Sort of a diagram of the different stages that people typically seem to go through, and I don't know if it's entirely universal, but it certainly, like I said, has resonance. Initially, when, you know, a very happy, there it is, right there, thank you. The five stages of couples they go through, does this seem, in your experience, to be pretty universal?
It is. Thank you for giving me a chance to talk about
yeah.
it. I'll try not to go on too much. It's very interesting to me.
I thought it was fascinating.
The first stage of the couples, they have everything you focus on is how much you are alike.
Mm-hmm.
And you pick up things and you really value your partner, sometimes for very surface things. I've had people say, you know, "I'm madly in love with my husband because he drives a cute black truck." It's like, oh,
okay.
Boy, honey, it's going to be a long road for you. The second stage is the stage that usually occurs right when you have kids. And if you're not in that stage, having kids will just push you right into that. And that's the, who the heck are you? Who have I married? And you start to notice all the little tiny ways that you're different. You know, you like the thermostat high, I like it low. The just minutiae of everyday life, plus bigger things. Having children makes you think about your values. Who do I want this child to become? What do I want them to experience? And you feel empowered that this is what I really need and want. And so things that you let go and didn't matter suddenly matter to you. This is the stage that you're, you get into, that if my partner would just change this little bit, they'd be perfect. And you sort of say, and how long are you going to wait for this little bit? Because it doesn't usually happen because they're under the gun of having kids. And I don't mean to say that kids are bad, because it's the best thing that ever happened to me, and it's wonderful to have kids. But there is some stress there, and it heightens this second stage. And some couples will stay stuck there for many, many years. But couples that go on to be happy move through the other three stages. So they... The next stage is resolving the identity conflicts of who am I going to be? What kind of mom am I going to be? What kind of dad am I going to be? What kind of career am I going to have? And you're often, as a couple, somewhat separated. And then in the fourth stage, you kind of make peace with all those little nitpicky things, and you just decide you're going to live with whatever disappointment it is that's bothering you. For me, it was, I fantasized we'd have these big family dinners. I had these two highly active boys and an active husband, and they couldn't sit through dinner for 4 minutes. And so I had to let go of that. And interestingly enough, letting go of it, he began to start. We began to start having family dinners once I stopped pushing on him. Mm. And that's often what happens. You decide to be civil and to stop fighting about things, and then you start to resolve things. And if you... Truly, and you're not particularly passionate at that point necessarily, you're just friends again. Then in the fifth stage, you have a really deeper level of intimacy where there's a sense of, I know who he is, he knows who I am, and we know who we are together, what our shared values are for our children. And a real sense of being supported about the things that we share, but loving the other person for their uniqueness. And the example that I draw for couples is that if you think about parents that where their child has, you know, if they're a doctor, they have to train their kid how to be a doctor. And, you know, if they're a lawyer, they have to train their kid to be a lawyer. And that's what the kid has to be. And the kid may discover, you know, after they've gone through law school, that it's not what they really wanted to do. And it's loving your spouse in the way you really love a child, where you want your child to be who they are and to follow their own talents. And loving your spouse in that way, and feeling loved that way yourself, that somebody really knows you and likes who you are, is a very different kind of love than somebody who loves you because you have a shiny black truck.
Indeed.
So it was interesting to me that there's sort of a coming apart and coming back together that, that happy couples go through. And it's a pretty universal stage that mirrors the development of your children, very interestingly, because... Both at age 0 to 5, your children go through a parallel of where they have no sense of the difference between mommy and me. And then gradually they go through that no stage. And then they go through the stage where they run and grab your leg. And then they run away because they're trying to find out who they are. And then they come back to where they're closer to you and they're more connected to you. And then in the teenage years, they have to go through the separation again and then come back to some sense of who our family is. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, I told you I'd babble about this.
That's okay. No, it's interesting.
Interestingly, you are more, it's easier for you to go through these stages if your own family of origin allowed you to go through and be who you are than if your own family of origin had to have you be exactly who your parents were. So if you got to go through these twice as a kid, it's much easier then for you to go through them as an adult in your married life. So if you can do this for yourself and have a healthy development with your kids, you're also setting them up to have a happy marriage later on.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned that these seem to be timed to the stages of the kids in, you know, in married couples. And I believe, if I recall correctly, that the really dangerous age is like from 2 to 5 or something.
Yes, that's the time that 67% of couples say they're less happier than they were.
Yeah.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, from 2 to 5, a kid is really establishing their sense of power and control in the world. And it provokes all these control issues in the parents with each other. So you sort of act out what they're learning. Unless you learn a different way to manage it, mm-hmm. different way to handle it.
So then when the kids are a little bit older, say 6 to 9 or 10 or something like that, this is a stage that is a little less stressful in general?
It should be less stressful if you've gotten habits in order. In fact, many people will say our marriage is the best it's been mm-hmm. since the kids came along when the kids turned 6. That's a common thing that you hear if they're getting better. But you will see couples that will stay stuck in this stage too, 17 years. Mm. I mean, really, like the kids go off to college and they're still trying to change their partner that last little bit and not resolving. It's very hard on the kids too because they're not available. If they're in that kind of war with each other, they're not available for their kids.
Then in the teenage years,
uh-huh.
Which, you know, I haven't gotten to yet, but... That's a whole, it seemed, you know, from all the stories I'm hearing from my colleagues, a whole other ball game.
It is another ball game, and it's very abrupt for parents because your kids idealize you pretty much from 8 to 12 if you have a good, you know, if you've solved the first stage and then they kind of idealize you. And so you feel close to them in this sense of closeness, and then their hormones hit and they have all this intense feeling and they need to separate from you again and find out who they really are going to be as adults. And, of course, they're going to do things that you're not comfortable with. And it's going back to giving them choices. And you have to be available in a way that you were when they were really young again, that you haven't had to be available, I think. Just... like my husband and I no longer traveled out of town for a couple of years in there, and we just, it wasn't safe because they're too old for the babysitter. We had a wonderful grandmother who would come in and stay, you know, oh, grandma wants to see you if we needed to go do something. Because they couldn't have a babysitter. And it's just, you know, that they will try things that are really dangerous before their impulse control has kicked in. And so it's a fine art not to be disrespectful to them and still set appropriate limits and help guide them through choices. And then if you do, if you concentrate really hard, I think, in that 13 to 15, then it actually gets fun again to have teenagers as they get older. But it's a challenge.
We have just about 10 minutes left with our guest, Dr. Carol Lindquist. She is a family therapist, and she's visiting Champaign-Urbana. We'll be appearing tomorrow at Pages for All Ages at 2 o'clock. That's Pages for All Ages in Savoy, Illinois, to sign copies of her book, Happily Married with Kids, published by Berkeley Press. And that's what we're talking about during this hour. If you'd like to join us real quick, we'll try to include you in our conversation. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We had a question, I guess, off the air, and this is, I think, a common one, how to make sure that the dad and the mom have a common policy on bringing up babies or toddlers so there is no conflict. In an ideal world, there would be no conflict, but this is an issue that is very common. The parents have different attitudes on what the rules should be.
Yes, it is. And in an interesting way, that's not necessarily harmful to your children. What I tell my clients is the 30% rule, that if you only disagree 30% of the time, you're about average and you're doing great. If you're only disagreeing 10% of the time, you're doing fabulously and you just have such high perfectionistic standards you haven't figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I say the important thing for you and the kids is that you have a mechanism for resolving the conflict. And couples do that very differently. Some couples say, well, dad makes all the decisions about the athletics and mom makes the decisions about school. Or some couples say, well, mom and dad talk it over and come to some agreement before we talk to you. So they each do, they define the areas and they fight in a way that's a clean fight, that uses the good communication skills that I talk about in the books and in the communication tips. And so they model for their kids not an absence of conflict, which is actually kind of crippling to kids, because in the real world you're going to disagree with people. But they model how to resolve that conflict in a healthy, respectful way. So it actually can be a good thing to have that conflict.
I hope that gets at the question of the listener.
I hope so, too.
And again, last-minute calls are welcome. We just have about 8 minutes left, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. There's a couple issues I wanted to raise. Is there anything else that you wanted to make sure that we talk about? Well, in terms of our expectations, we talked a lot about that. How do we deal with disappointments of those expectations, I guess, is another big issue.
Well, one thing I talk about in the book that's fun and sort of addresses that is it's actually something Michelle Weiner Davis talks about, which is truce triggers. And that is, I try to get – couples will come in and they'll tell you exactly everything that led up to a fight and who said what to whom. And what I always ask them is, so how did you resolve it? In other words, learn your truce triggers. How do you as a couple start over? When you've had a fight, or if the fight's going badly, how do you stop the fight and start on a good track? And so I try to get them to identify a word or a phrase that says, this fight isn't going in a good place, let's go a different way. And I had one of my favorite couples, their worst fight of all times was over putting up the Christmas tree lights. And so when they'd start to have another bad fight, they'd go, Christmas tree lights, which roughly translated meant, we don't ever want to have that kind of fight again.
Right.
So I try to help them either create a truce trigger or develop. For some people, it's just giving each other a hug. Or for some people, it's let's separate and we'll agree to talk about this at a specific time, later. But then do come back and talk about it. That's an important part of it. But to have a truce trigger that says, this feels yucky. We love each other. Let's start over and have this conversation when we're not as tired or when we've got a better attitude. Or some couples will stop and say, five things they like about each other and then continue the conversation. And it's just a completely different conversation.
So they need to work out a method for dealing with that.
That works for them. So for some people, it's mirroring. Mm-hmm. When it gets bad, when you see your partner getting upset, you just stop and you start repeating back to them what they're saying so that they know you hear them before you move on. Lots of different things, but you need the method that works for you as a couple, because you're going to have conflict and you're going to need do-overs.
One of the issues that I wanted to ask you about is it has to do with politics. We've had a proposal by the president to essentially try to give some resources to encourage people to get married. And I think there was a figure floated, $1.5 billion spent on programs to promote marriage. And I guess, the question might be, how exactly do you do that? And also one of the questions that I would ask is maybe sometimes, people shouldn't be married. I mean, I don't know, how do you go about assessing, whether the government ought to be promoting people getting married?
Well, there's things that you can do to help promote marriage. I think if you're really interested in this, there's a website, smartmarriages.com, that has lots of material on factual basis for why, from a political standpoint, married couples do better financially. They provide their kids do better. There's a lot of things from a social stand, if you want to look at it as a social policy issue, that works better in a bonded family unit. Now, I spent years working in domestic violence area, and clearly, and actually, in domestic violence, I never said, go divorce your batterer. What I would say is, you need to separate because it's not safe for you and your kids to be around somebody that does this. Now, if he goes to treatment and really can resolve that, or he's willing to, commit it. And many of these guys just had very poor childbearing, and they don't know how to be parents and partners any differently. Mm-hmm. So I don't I think that you divorce when things really aren't going to work for you and for your kids. And I think there are many situations like that. But I think too often we get divorced because we enter in that differences stage and we think we can't live like this. And we don't see that there's light at the end of the tunnel and there could be a coming back together. So I think from the Smart Marriage, and they were big proponents of this legislation, that if you can get a long-term view of marriage and you can see that it's one of the greatest gifts you can give to your children is a healthy marriage, there are things that you can do to show people that there are ways to resolve these things and that there are supports for them. On the other hand, saying to somebody you have to stay married when your husband batters you is just plain evil. I mean, it's a bad thing. So I don't ever – I'm not as clearly I wouldn't say pro-marriage in the face of those kinds of difficulties, but I think there are strong reasons to try to do everything you can to save a marriage for yourself and your children.
We have one other caller. Let's include them before we run out of time. We'll have to be kind of quick, though. Sorry about that. Line number four, Newman. Good morning.
Yeah, I used to teach total quality management and teamworking skills for the government, and I just wanted to point out that all of the things that you're talking about here for relationship building and relationship healing go on in the work environment, too, for teams, and people can bring those skills home and take the skills that they learn at home and take them to work, and maybe they'll make the whole lives better. I'll listen off post. Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much for the call.
I think he's absolutely right. If you can get people to use those team-building skills at home, it's a wonderful thing. And I think when you think about legislation, if you can develop media programs and stuff that and interactive programs that teach people those kinds of skills, more marriages will survive. You see so many people that are getting a divorce that really are perfectly suited to each other but don't know how to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to stop there. There's much more we could talk about and much more in the book. So I will mention the title again for listeners, Happily Married with Kids. And it is published by Berkeley Press, and you should be able to find that in bookstores and libraries. And among those bookstores, tomorrow at 2 p.m., Pages for All Ages in Savoy. Carol Lindquist will be signing copies of the book then. That's 2 o'clock tomorrow. If you'd like to meet her and get a copy of the book, then you can certainly do that. And to you, Dr. Lindquist, thanks so much for talking with us. It's been very interesting.
Well, thank you for having me.
It's a great book.
Thank you.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Programming on WILL AM is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where Jazz Threads, a community-wide jazz performance and education project, continues the first week of March with performances by trumpeter Cecil Bridgewater and Clark Terry and the Meta Quintet of the Jazz Reach program. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
And that's it for Focus 580 for this morning. Time to hand things off to Jay Pierce, a man wearing many hats around here, hosting the Afternoon Magazine today. Jay?
Have to keep the bald spot covered, so I have to wear a lot of hats. Jack? Oh, Jack disappeared.